Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Locked On Orioles, the podcast that gives you unrivaled coverage of the birds from the clubhouse to the warehouse and beyond. It's all O's all the time. As always, I'm your host, Justin McGuire. I'm a veteran baseball journalist who spent 8 years as a senior editor at Sporting News. I also host a podcast called Baseball by the Book. I'm a former Cy Young and Rookie of the Year voter. And most importantly, I'm a lifelong Orioles fan. Today, we introduce a new segment that I hope to make a regular thing. It's called O's History, and I think the concept is pretty self-explanatory. The basic idea is that with this segment, we'll go back and look at some aspect of Orioles history in depth. Today, we're joined by author Jeremy Lehrman. He and I take a look back at the Orioles MVP winners of the past, from Brooks Robinson in 1964 to Cal Ripken Jr. in 1991. As I say, I hope to make this a regular segment, but I'm hoping that we can come up with a better name than O's History. So if you have an idea, please shoot it my way. You can send me an email at lockedonorioles@gmail.com, or you can hit us up on Twitter. It's @LockedOnOrioles. So if somebody comes up with a name that we end up using, I'll send you a prize of some sort. I don't really know what that's going to be yet, but we'll figure something out. So just send me any ideas you have for the segment on O's History. Also, I want to remind everybody that we now have a website, lockedonorioles.com. All our episodes will live there. Plus, we'll have more Orioles news and analysis coming later on. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, so please subscribe, leave a rating, and leave a review. As I record this, the Orioles just completed a game against the St. Louis Cardinals in the Grapefruit League. First, the good news. Manny Machado hit a grand slam in this game. Chris Davis hit a three-run homer. Trey Mancini and Ryan Mountcastle each had solo shots. And the Orioles had a 9-1 lead going into the seventh inning. Now the bad news. They ended up losing 10-9 after the Cardinals scored 8 runs in the 7th and another in the 8th. Well, it's just a spring training game, so I don't think we're going to get too concerned about it, but it does mean the Orioles are now 1-5 in the Grapefruit League. Again, this is spring training. It's early spring training. There's no reason to panic or be concerned, but it still would have been nice to win this one, wouldn't it? And you go up 9-1, even if it's just a spring training game, it really seems like a game you should win. And I feel like this is the kind of thing we might be seeing a lot of out of the 2018 Orioles, where they're capable of hitting a lot of homers, but they're also going to give up a lot of runs. A frustrating game, but it's just now March 1st, so I don't think there's any reason to panic yet. In a couple weeks, we'll revisit this and see if we think it's time to panic. And it is the 2018 Orioles, so panic may be an emotion you want to get your head around right now. Okay, one other thing. Just wanted to mention, if you're interested in sponsoring Locked On Orioles, or if you have suggestions for topics or guests for the show, please drop me a line at lockedonorioles@gmail.com. As I said, you can also contact us on Twitter, @LockedOnOrioles. I really want to get feedback from listeners. I want to know what kind of topics you're interested in. I want to know if you're interested in being a guest, if you're somebody who has some expertise on the Orioles or other aspects of baseball. And I want to know what's working and what's not working with this thing. So please feel free to let me know. Also, of course, if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, I really want to hear from you. There's opportunities to sponsor Locked On Orioles, or more broadly, you can be a sponsor on the entire Locked On MLB network. So get in touch if you have an interest in that. We're putting together a great group of podcasters, and there's already active podcasts for Yankees, Cubs, Twins, Angels, and a bunch of other teams. So just let us know, because I think this is going to be a great opportunity for somebody who wants to reach a very sophisticated baseball audience. Okay, let's get on with our O's History segment. Okay, everybody, we're back, and we're joined by author Jeremy Lehrman. He wrote a book called Baseball's Most Baffling MVP Ballots, and in fact, he was a guest on my other podcast a long time ago. In fact, Jeremy, I think you were the second ever guest I had on Baseball by the Book.
I think that's right. Great to be with you again, Justin. Thanks for having me.
All right, so the reason you're here today is I wanted to take a look back at Oriole MVP history and take a look at the gentlemen who have won MVP in an Orioles uniform. And kind of look at it from the perspective of your book. And your book basically looks at cases in which somebody won the MVP and maybe it was a questionable decision for a number of reasons. So let's just do it that way. We'll go and we'll look at the Orioles MVP winners and I'll ask you whether the choice was baffling or not baffling. And you can tell us a little bit about that. Now, I should point out, and I think Orioles fans know this, that no Oriole has won MVP since Cal Ripken in 1991. So this is really history we're talking about. There hasn't been a good MVP candidate for the Orioles in a long time. Hopefully that will change soon. All right. Well, anyway, let's go back to the very beginning. In 1964, Brooks Robinson won American League MVP. He was the first Oriole to ever win the award. tell us, was that a baffling choice or not?
No, that wasn't a baffling choice. Robinson was an easy and worthy choice as American League MVP. You know, these were the days when the Yankees had a vice grip on the AL pennant, and the 64 Orioles took a lot of people by surprise, you know, keeping pace with Mantle's Yanks until late September. And this was the last of the great Mickey Mantle teams, actually. And Robinson had a career year. He basically set highs in virtually every offensive category. He was, of course, his usual platinum glove caliber defense, a fan favorite, came to play every single day. Easy choice for MVP. And, you know, he was never again a hitter at the level he was in 1964, but certainly was a deserving Hall of Famer over the course of his career.
Who else in 1964 American League had a good year? Were there any other candidates besides Robinson, or was he a runaway winner?
Well, Robinson in the voting was certainly a runaway winner. This was Mantle's last very good year. If you look at today's advanced analytics, Robinson did lead position players in wins above replacement, which again didn't exist in 1964, so it hardly entered into the voting. But he really was a clear choice and an easy choice for the writers. So in this case, there was really nobody who you could make a very persuasive case for over Robinson as MVP.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear that because Brooks Robinson is my favorite player of all time. And I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before that I named my dog. My first dog was named Brooks. I attended Brooks Robinson's Hall of Fame induction ceremony in 1983. So I'm glad to hear that he was a deserving choice for his only time he won the MVP. All right. Well, let's fast forward 2 years. The second Oriole to win an MVP was the other Robinson, Frank Robinson. He was in his first year with the Orioles. He had been traded from the Reds for Milt Pappas and because he had famously was old for 30 or something like that, I think the Reds management said. And, of course, he comes over and immediately wins the Triple Crown in the American League. So I'll ask you if this is baffling or not, but I think the answer is going to be pretty obvious, although I will state that throughout history, and we talked about this, I think, when you were on my other podcast, throughout history, Triple Crown winners have not always won the MVP. And in fact, a couple of years ago when Miguel Cabrera won it, there was a bit of a controversy because a lot of the people who, you know, the more advanced stats types thought that Mike Trout deserved it over Cabrera, despite the fact that Cabrera won the Triple Crown. So I guess it is possible to have a Triple Crown winner who isn't really the most valuable player in the league. So let's talk about Frank Robinson in 1966. Baffling choice or not baffling choice?
Yeah, this if there was ever an obvious choice, if there was ever a choice that was not baffling, as you said, it was Frank Robinson in 1966. And if ever a player could be forgiven for taking a little extra satisfaction in receiving the award, it was Robinson. You know, as you noted, Robinson had starred for Cincinnati for a decade. He was one of the very best players in the National League over that time. And Robinson's one of the very best players who's ever lived. He's somewhat underrated, I think, when compared to contemporaries like Mays and Aaron. He was every bit as good. He's traded to the Orioles in the winter of 1965. And, you know, as a parting shot, Cincinnati's general manager, Bill DeWitt, when asked, you know, why'd you trade Robinson? He's only 30 years old. And then the response was, well, he's an old 30. So what does Robinson do? He goes and he hits for a Triple Crown. He was nicknamed the Judge, you know, long before Aaron Judge, of the Yankees rookie. You know, Robinson was the Judge, and he sentenced the American League to hard time. You know, hit for the Triple Crown, but it was a bruising Triple Crown. He really dominated the league in every way that you can dominate. He claimed a unanimous MVP award, and he'd go on to play six mostly excellent years with the Orioles. He helped them to a world title in 1970. And, you know, it is one of the all-time great thefts. You know, this was grand larceny, the Orioles acquiring Robbins for Milt Pappas. And Robinson, of course, went on to manage some of the worst Orioles teams who ever lived, to ever take the field, you know, especially the 1988 team. But he holds a special place in Orioles history and a deserved place in Orioles history. A very, very worthy MVP in 1966.
Yeah. And, obviously when I ask about that one, it's kind of the most obvious one on here because again, it's the circumstances that all those stuff that you mentioned, not to mention the fact that the Orioles win the pennant for the first time ever in Baltimore. They had won one previously in St. Louis, but that had been during the war and didn't mean anything to anybody in Baltimore. So not only does he come over and win the Triple Crown, but he leads this team that had been kind of on the cusp for a while and leads them to their first ever pennant. Yeah, it's hard to imagine a more just a more quintessential MVP season when you think about it.
Yeah, and this was the season Robinson became, I believe, to this day, he's still the only player to capture the Most Valuable Player award in both leagues.
Okay, so let's move on. 4 years later, this is still basically the same group of players, 1970, and Brooks Robinson and Frank Robinson are still around. But the MVP that year goes to the first baseman on the team, Boog Powell. And, of course, contemporary Orioles fans know Boog Powell. He runs the Boog's Barbecue stand at Camden Yards. He can still be seen around a lot. He's a fan favorite to this day. But unlike Brooks Robinson in 1964 or Frank Robinson in 1966, I think this selection is a bit more controversial and a bit more questionable. So Boog Powell, 1970, baffling or not baffling?
It wasn't baffling because it's completely reasonable and understandable MVP. Was he the best player in the American League that year? No, no. Kari Yastrzemski was far and away the best player in the league. But listen, Boog Powell was arguably the best position player on what was clearly the best team. The 1969 through 71 Orioles are one of the greatest teams in history. And the 1970 squad, of course, I believe that was the year they took the World Series. You know, and so Powell certainly rates as a reasonable choice. You know, you get on base at a 400 clip, you hit 35 home runs in 1970, no less. You're always good. That makes a reasonable MVP choice. And, you know, if you look like you're the DH in a beer league softball league, you know, all the better. Powell at the time was kind of a cult favorite. He's grown into a certifiable Baltimore icon. So a reasonable MVP choice, certainly not one of the worst choices of all time. He can proudly he could look to that plaque and say, you know, I earned it, and I think he did. Now, what wasn't reasonable, Justin, was if you look at the 1970 ballot as a whole, and you look down at some of the down ballot madness, and Ron Paranowski, who was a reliever for the Minnesota Twins, he received a first place vote. You say, well, okay, so, you know, sometimes you have these throwaway votes and the home team sometimes gets a vote. Well, this is one more first place vote than Jim Palmer, Mike Cuellar, and Dave McNally received combined. This three-headed monster, they went 68-37 that year, didn't get a single MVP vote among them. So if you're looking at 1970, the ballot as a whole, the ballot was a little bit baffling. Boog was not a baffling choice as your ultimate MVP winner.
And you mentioned, you know, Carl Yastrzemski being the best player in the league. What were there other players in the mix for consideration for MVP?
Yeah, there were. You know, Boog Powell was certainly not close to a unanimous winner. Tony Oliva on the Twins got serious consideration, and he deserved it. You know, he was his typical hitting machine. Harmon Killebrew, who had taken the award the previous year, followed up on his MVP season with another 40 home run and 100, well over 100 walks, and was an on-base machine. And Yastrzemski, who didn't quite follow his or didn't repeat his Triple Crown season of 1967, but he was just about as good in every way. Yastrzemski, I believe that year, hit .329 with a .452 on-base percentage, 40 home runs, played his typical excellent left field, and overall rated as the best player in the league. That said, as we know, the best player doesn't necessarily translate to most valuable. And in this case, it was Boog Powell.
All right, so we're going to fast forward more than a decade here. The previous guys we've mentioned, the Robinsons and Powell, like I said, they were teammates. They were together for that run of greatness from the Orioles from 1966 through 1971 when they won the World Series twice, went two other times. And, you know, part of the sort of most legendary team in Orioles history, I would say. By the time the Orioles win another MVP, all those guys are retired. They're all out of the league. In fact, this year we're talking about 1983, Brooks Robinson was inducted into the Hall of Fame that year. Frank Robinson had been inducted the previous year. So it's a totally new era in Orioles history. But the Orioles win the AL East that year. And the MVP goes to their second-year shortstop, the guy who had won the rookie of the year the previous year. And I think even Orioles fans today are probably familiar with this guy, Cal Ripken Jr. Baffling choice or non-baffling choice in 1983?
Not baffling at all. Cal Ripken Jr. was the best and most valuable commodity in baseball. The only question about Cal Ripken really at this point, and this certainly isn't going to be controversial with your listeners, Justin, is you know, where does Cal Ripken rate all time amongst shortstops? Is he the best of all time, the second best of all time, or maybe, if you want to stretch credulity, maybe the third greatest shortstop of all time? The 1983 vote, MVP vote, was a deserved win for Ripken. It was a little closer than people might remember, however. Eddie Murray, his great teammate, a Hall of Famer in his own right, captured 10 first place votes. Ripken took the award with 15 first-place votes. So this was not a runaway vote for Ripken. And it probably should have been, if only because people forgot, you know, two decades of Derek Jeter and Alex Rodriguez and for a time Nomar Garciaparra have kind of spoiled folks. Cal Ripken was a singular type of player in his day. We're used to the 6'3", 6'4", 240-pound shortstop today who can hit 35 home runs and also field his position like Louis Aparicio. But Cal Ripken broke the mold. Players like Cal Ripken just simply didn't exist before he came along. If you have an elite defensive shortstop who hits like an elite slugging first baseman, and that's essentially what Ripken did in 1983, well, that's the stuff of which MVPs are made. So a deserving choice in 1983 for Cal Ripken Jr.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just want to go on a sidetrack here for a second. You mentioned that Eddie Murray finished second in the voting that year. He also finished second the year before to Robin Yount, another shortstop who led his team to a division title and won a deserving MVP award. And I think I have to go back and look at what this exactly was, but Eddie Murray finished in the top five in American League MVP voting for something like six straight years or something like that. I forget the exact number, but MVP voters really liked Eddie Murray in that era.
You know, it's funny. MVP voters loved Eddie Murray, just not quite enough.
Right.
You're absolutely right. From 1981 to 1985, Murray had five top five MVP finishes, including, as you mentioned, the back-to-back runner-ups in 1982 and 1983. You can't really say he was robbed in any of those votes. Well, everybody was robbed in 1981 and 1984 when the writers gave the award to a couple of relievers. But, you know, Murray's MVP showings kind of reflected his status within the game. You know, he was one of the best, just short of being the best, but certainly nothing to be ashamed of. He was appreciated in his day. He's probably a little bit underappreciated as time goes on, which is probably more a function of Murray just being a quiet, reserved guy as opposed to somebody whose accomplishments on the field don't speak volumes.
Yeah, and I also felt like he has been overshadowed a bit simply because he played in, you know, his prime years were in the 80s. And, of course, the next decade, people like him started hitting 45 to 50 homers every year. He never had that kind of year. He never had a year that, like, if you look back at him from the vantage point of the 90s or early 2000s, his years look nice but nothing special. But the reality is that they were pretty special in the context of the 80s.
That's absolutely right. He was just consistently excellent. And if you were to kind of drop Eddie Murray in a time machine and advance him to the height of the Selig steroid era, Eddie Murray's 30 home run, 110 RBI, 300 batting average seasons, you know, those look like 40 home run, 120 RBI seasons. And all of a sudden, Eddie Murray's true status as a slugger really emerges.
All right, so let's fast forward now to the final MVP the Orioles have won so far in their history, 1991. It's the same guy we just talked about, Cal Ripken Jr. He wins his second MVP, but under very different circumstances. 1991, by that time, the Orioles had fallen on hard times. They had, you know, in that period from 1983 to 1991, they had kind of fallen off a cliff for the most part. You mentioned 1988 when they finished when they started the year 0-21. They had a number of last place and below 500 finishes in that era. You know, with a notable exception of 1989 when they took the Blue Jays down to the last weekend of the season with a chance to win the division and kind of a fluky year. But otherwise, it had been not a great era in Orioles history. And they actually finished below 500 in 1991 as well, which makes Cal Ripken's choice as MVP somewhat unusual historically. So let's look at that year, 1991, Cal Ripken Jr. Baffling choice or not baffling choice?
A somewhat baffling choice, but here's why. It's not because Cal Ripken Jr. wasn't the best player in the league. He was. He was the best player in the league by a mile. By some advanced metrics, Ripken's 1991 season has a case as the best season ever by a shortstop. That might be hard to believe for some when you think about folks like Honus Wagner and A-Rod and Robin Yount in 1982 had one of the great seasons ever by a shortstop. That's how good Cal Ripken really was in 1991. So as a player, Ripken was, if you equate best player with most valuable, he was the most valuable player in the league. However, some purists would argue, well, the Orioles went 67-95 in 1991. How valuable could Cal Ripken have been? They could have finished, 40 games out of first place without Cal Ripken. I don't buy into that argument necessarily. I think that team standing can and should influence MVP voting if it's a deciding factor between two players who have very, very similar cases. But in 1991, there was no one even close to Cal Ripken in terms of on-field performance. So I'm going to hedge a little bit here, Justin. It's baffling in the sense that it went against accepted MVP voting logic. Ripken was only the third player at the time from a losing team to claim the award. A couple of Cubs, Ernie Banks and Andre Dawson had previously done the trick, and later A-Rod and Mike Trout as recently as 2016 have done the same. So Ripken was a little baffling in terms of expectations, but he was deserving in terms of on-field performance.
That the voters overlooked the fact that the Orioles weren't any good to vote for him. Because like you said, especially then, it was considered to be an award that goes to a player on a good team, preferably a postseason team, but in any case, a contender. But his numbers were just so overwhelming, and he was so clearly better than everybody else that the voters essentially had no choice but to give him the award. That's kind of how I felt about it at the time, anyway.
I think that's absolutely accurate, because there were some other quality candidates, so to speak. Cecil Fielder had led the league in home runs for the second consecutive year. And back in Big Cecil's time, hitting 51 and then 44 home runs, it meant something. This was before, 15 guys might hit 40 home runs in a given season. This is Frank Thomas's spectacular rookie season. Jose Canseco hit 44 home runs that year. Joe Carter drove in a bushel of runs. And as we all know, MVP voters love RBI. So the voters had other choices. They went with Ripken, and it was absolutely the right choice.
All right, so we've looked at the Orioles who won the MVP award, and again, recently as 1991, and we haven't had one since then. All right, so let's look at a question from a different perspective. Are there Orioles players throughout history who didn't win the MVP but maybe should have?
It's an interesting question. Are there Orioles players that should have won the MVP? And the answer, sadly, is probably not. There are Oriole players that have done very well in the voting and have had some near misses. We already talked about Eddie Murray. Really, the voting, and as you mentioned earlier, it has been now since 1991, so we're talking about 27 seasons since an Oriole has taken the award. Seems like a long time, and it is, but Orioles fans can take solace in the fact that, look, the Cleveland hasn't had an MVP since 1953, so the Orioles have a ways to go. One of the great overlooked seasons, and I think it's worth mentioning, is 1961 by Diamond Jim Gentile. Why is this notable? So Gentile received 5 first-place votes in 1961. You say, well, okay, that's nice and all, and his third place finish was fine, but why are we talking about it? Well, 1961, of course, is famous in baseball history, and this is the year that Roger Maris took the MVP award in a very narrow and controversial vote over Mickey Mantle, obviously on the strength of his home run record. Gentile had one of the great seasons in Baltimore history this year. He never came close to replicating what he did with the bat this year. You know, folks of a certain age and a certain generation will remember, you know, Big Diamond Jim as a slugger who, with immense power, who just really kind of never put it all together except for this one year. And he ended up leading the league in RBI in a year that Roger Maris had 61 home runs. So no small feat. He came in third. Those five first place votes probably should have went to Mickey Mantle, and it probably ended up costing Mickey Mantle an MVP that he deserved. So the Orioles can take some satisfaction that they stuck it to the Yankees. Well, not really, since Maris took the award. So, forget I said that, but they stuck it to Mickey Mantle. So maybe they take some satisfaction in that. But other than that, you know, the Orioles have not really had a, we hate to be unkind, but they have not had the greatest historical showing in the MVP vote. The most recent Oriole to make some noise in the voting was Chris Davis in 2013. He finished third in the vote, and this is the year that he led the league in home runs and RBI. This is also the year, though, that Miguel Cabrera actually improved on his Triple Crown season the year prior. And Cabrera was a worthy MVP choice, and Mike Trout, for the second year, finished runner-up to Cabrera, was also a very worthy runner-up, at least worth runner-up. You know, had strong argument that he was the MVP. And then there was Chris Davis, who had a fine year, of course, and finished about where he should have in 2013.
Okay, everybody, that does it for today's episode of Locked On Orioles. Big thanks to Jeremy Lehrman for joining me. And remember, his book is called Baseball's Most Baffling MVP Ballots. You can find it on Amazon and other places where books are sold. And I definitely encourage you to check it out. It's a really interesting book, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. Please join us next time when our guest will be Sporting News national baseball writer Ryan Fagan. See you then.